This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After her two best-selling books, Metropolitan Life in 1978 and Social Studies in 1981, Fran Lebowitz was hailed as one of the wittiest writers of her generation. But soon after that second bestseller, she became famous for her writer's block, which lasted over a decade. Now she says the block is over and she's at work again on a novel. Meanwhile, essays from her first two books are collected in the new anthology, The Fran Lebowitz Reader. And she has a new children's book called Mr. Chass and Lisa Sue Meet the Pandas. We invited Fran Lebowitz to talk about writing and not writing. Let's start with a reading from an essay in her new collection. These are variations on the theme of not writing, the topic that she says preoccupies most writers.
Variation on this theme number one. You can't write. You call another writer. He can't write either. This is terrific. You can now talk about not writing for 2 hours and then go out to dinner with each other until 4 o'clock in the morning. Variation on this theme number two. You can't write. You call another writer. He is writing. This is a great tragedy. He will talk to you only as long as it takes for him to impress upon you the fact that not only is he writing, but he thinks that what he is writing is quite possibly the best thing he's ever written. Your only alternative to suicide in this situation is to call a rock musician. This makes you feel smart again, and you can get on with the business of not writing. Variation on this theme number three. You are writing. Another writer calls you to talk about not writing. You announce that you are. Masochistically, he inquires as to what it is that you are writing. You inform him modestly that it's just a little something vaguely reminiscent of, say, an ideal husband, perhaps a bit funnier. Your behavior at his funeral the following day is marked by enormous dignity and grace.
Fran, when did you write that?
I think I was in my 20s. I'm in my 40s now.
Are the feelings expressed in that reading still feelings that you have?
Actually, not in the sense that I don't think about other writers at all anymore, which I guess I did then. If my life was more collegial at that time, by which I mean I hung out in bars all the time, and so that I think I had more contact with other people in that way, you know, perhaps more competitive in the sense of were they getting work done. Now I just assume everyone is getting more work done than I am, and I go from there.
It's interesting because you have, you know, you became famous for your writing, and then you became famous for not writing. In a way, it's really quite a racket. I mean, you're very famous for not doing something. Can you make a living not writing?
Well, I did. Barely. I mean, you don't do very well. Let's put it that way. No, I didn't make a living not writing, but I managed to make a living even though I wasn't writing.
Doing what?
Talking. Mostly what I did during the several thousand years that I wasn't working was I did a seriously inordinate number of college lecture dates, by which I mean almost nonstop. And so I just talked. I read from my old books, which were getting older and older. and then I would answer questions from the audience in an entertaining fashion. And I did that. I went from college to college. I was the Willie Loman of literature. It was a very depressing period of my life.
So we're talking about this in the past tense. It's ended?
Yes, it's been ended for about 2.5 years.
And you're writing what?
I'm writing a novel.
Called?
Exterior Signs of Wealth.
Now, that's the novel you said you were writing in the early 80s.
Yes, that's the novel that I was supposed to be writing when I finished social studies. The idea was that I would now write this novel called Exterior Signs of Wealth, but then I stopped writing. So when I started writing again about 2.5 years ago, it was the same title and in certain respects the same novel, although, of course, not at all the novel I would have written then.
What changed that made you able to write again?
And I really don't know. I mean, just as I don't really know exactly why I couldn't write, but perhaps in some way my fear of writing became eclipsed by my fear of not writing. You know, 10 years, that's serious. You know, you begin to say, well, this is serious. Also, I think that what happened was it became harder work not to write than to write. And so I went with the easier thing.
Well, what do you like and what do you hate about writing?
Well, I used to say that I liked nothing about writing, that what I liked about writing was having written. But now, in my middle years, I actually find writing to be, if not really pleasurable, at least more interesting than the rest of life. This probably is a function of my age. I mean, life is more interesting than writing when you're young, and life is newer. Now, I think it's more entertaining, at least to me, to reflect upon it than actually to have to live it. I mean, I don't know. Toni Morrison told me that she liked to write very much, and I said, why? And she said, because without writing, you're stuck with life. And that does become, or it has become true for me.
So could you talk a little bit about what the new novel is about, or would you prefer not to?
Oh, it's not that I prefer not to. It's kind of hard to describe. I mean, it's not a book that's easily described. I mean, I always think a book that's easily described is A Shark Came and Ate Everyone. It takes place over 20 years. It starts in 1971. It ends in 1990. It has, unlike most contemporary fiction, it has a large number of characters in it. I mean, something that's always struck me about contemporary fiction is, doesn't it seem to you like almost everyone in, all the characters in contemporary novels know practically no one? There are never more than four or five people in a book, and they only know two or three people. And although I would consider this to be a very happy state of affairs in reality, it's not true, I think, in most people's lives. So it has a great many characters, not a lot of plot. And it's set largely in New York, although there are scenes set elsewhere. It is meant to be funny, although not to the same extent that my essays were. In other words, I mean, that's not my primary concern while I'm writing it. And it's about a lot of things, including kind of the end of bohemianism, which I think is no longer a real possibility in this country.
Why not?
Because the media finds everything in 14 seconds, you know, no matter what it is. And because kids are so aware of it and so self-conscious that nothing truly marginal has a chance to really grow in any way before it's, you know, picked up in 1 second by some big magazine or something.
Let me say something that I've never quite understood about you. On the one hand, when I hear you talk, I always think of you as somebody who could probably live a solitary life just fine and doesn't really care what anybody thinks. And on the other hand, when I read about you, it's often in the context of some kind of scene, you know, being at a party or your views on the nightlife or something. I've never been able to reconcile the part of you that's gone to so many parties with the part of you that seems to me to exist as this kind of like solitary person not caring what others think.
So, I am both.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I'm alternately, unusually, and even gratuitously gregarious. On the other hand, I'm really very solitary. I've lived alone my entire life. My entire adult life. I've lived alone since I was 17. I would never consider living with another human being. It'd be out of the question. And when I'm not at a party or out in that way, I'm by myself reading. But I like both things. I mean, both things are important to me. At this point in my life, I would prefer to spend more time by myself. And especially when I'm really working on my novel, which I haven't been since I've been selling books as opposed to writing them. I rented a house in Princeton and I stayed there for 14 months and I very rarely came to New York. And I very rarely saw anyone at all. And I found it a very pleasurable experience.
Hmm. When you say you wouldn't ever live with anybody, not even a lover?
Especially not.
So do you find that it makes for a good relationship to not live together?
No.
That doesn't work either.
No. having good relationships in the way that you mean it has not been a priority in my life.
Oh, okay.
You know, I am the only person in my generation who doesn't think that you get to have every single thing in the world all at once.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or even ever. No, I'm sure that to have a very good relationship or a very good marriage, you have to devote quite a bit of attention to it. It's out of the question that I would be willing to do that.
Right.
I don't think that probably is a good idea.
I'm interested in your writing habits. You know how some writers have like a couple hours every day where they sit down and write and they're very disciplined about it?
Yes, I've read about them.
Have you ever tried that? Has that ever worked for you?
Well, I've always, that's the thing I really envy. For instance, they sent me all at once every Paris Review ever printed. And what did I do? I sat in my apartment for a month, read every single one. But what I was really interested in reading the Writers at Work series,
mm-hmm.
were things like how many hours a day did other writers write?
Mm-hmm.
And how much writing did they get done?
And how much is enough for a day?
And I'm always, you know, I actually don't have that many friends who are writers. And when I meet writers, that's the only thing I want to ask them. I mean, the fact is that if I met Proust, I would say, so, how many words do you get a day? You know, and do you write in the morning or at night? And do you think if you write in the daytime, you have more chance of getting more work? That would be my only interest. So that when I was living in Princeton, I was really getting work done. I worked in kind of two periods, you know, during the course of the day. I never, ever sat at a desk before 3 o'clock in the afternoon in my life. I mean, not since there was algebra homework on that desk, you know, not since I was a child. And then I would write from like 3 to like 7, and then starting again maybe about 10 to 4 or 5 in the morning. I always have had a habit of writing at night. When I was in Princeton, I tried also to write in the afternoons, since I realized that there was no point in just sitting around all day waiting for night to come, which is what I'd done most of my life. And it gave me gives you a second chance, so you don't feel so depressed if you don't get anything done the first time around. You know, but I've always found it easier to write at night, I suppose, because I'm more alert, first of all. And it just seems quieter.
No, I think in every writer, there's the writer and the editor. And sometimes the editor can choke the writer because you pick up, you know, you start writing, you go, oh, not good enough. Start over again. Oh, not good enough.
I don't think there's a difference. The writer and the editor. I mean, writing is editing.
But I mean, is there a part of you that you have to turn off in order to write, in order to, like, get out the sentence? And then you kind of summon back the editor to groom the sentence afterwards.
I've never been able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, inside of me is a Nazi general. You know? I mean, and that's why, you know, I write a sentence a day. No, the editor is not only present in me, but omniscient. We don't go on to the next syllable, to that previous syllable is perfect. So that I'm sure that I would write more if I was less critical of myself. But I am, you know, I'm just as critical of myself as I am of others. So that's pretty harsh.
Is that one of the things that makes it so hard to write?
It's one of the things that makes it so hard for me to write.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think you should make it hard for yourself to write so that you're easier to read. If you're easy on yourself when you write, you're going to be hard to read.
So it wouldn't work for you to just sit down and you know, let it flow, just write, not worry about how it reads, and then come back again another day and be really critical and edit it and rewrite it and so on.
Well, you know, I think that I don't write in drafts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that partially that's just a habit. You know, it's like saying I write with a pen as opposed to a pencil. But part of it is that when, you know, one of your chief concerns, if not your chief concern, is style, it's really impossible to do that. Writing in drafts is for people who have either information to extend to the reader, which I don't, or emotion. You know, I don't know, that must be the reason people do it. I'm simply unable to do that. You know, it's not that I think this is a better way to write, you know, or a worse way to write. It just, I would be unable to do that. I mean, my concern for, first of all, when you're writing things that have the intent to be humorous, you have very few tools at your disposal. And the primary tool that you have, other than what you're saying funny, is the rhythm of it. So that mostly what I'm doing when I'm writing is counting syllables so that the rhythm of the sentence is right. So if I replace a word, I have to replace it with a word of the same number of syllables. This, I realize, sounds probably totally insane to the people who are listening. But a lot of the time when I'm writing, that's what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
So that, and I constantly read aloud to myself, you know, while I'm writing. So it's just not really possible for me to write in drafts like that, although I'm sure I would get more work done.
Fran Lebowitz is my guest, and she has a new book called The Fran Lebowitz Reader, which is a kind of Fran Lebowitz's greatest hits kind of book. And she has a book for kids also called Mr. Chass and Lisa Sue Meet the Pandas. Fran, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk a little bit more.
Okay.
This is Fresh Air. Fran Lebowitz is my guest. Her book, The Fran Lebowitz Readers, collects some of her earlier essays, and she has a new children's book called Mr. Chass and Lisa Sue Meet the Pandas. If you don't mind my asking, you're in your, what, early 40s now? Mid 40s?
I'm 44.
44. Does being 44 bother you at all? Do you know what I mean? Like, if you get a gray hair, do you care? If you see wrinkles on your face, does that bother you?
First of all, I've had gray hairs since I was about 17.
Mm-hmm.
So that we're not at all surprised. But, you know, it turns out that my gray hair was just a phase. I don't have it anymore.
You outgrew your gray hair.
I outgrew it. So, you know, it just came and went.
Yeah.
Yes, of course, I can't stand getting older. I mean, I don't know anyone who likes it. Mainly because I think, or it seems to me, that I at least at some point in my life felt that age was immutable. In other words, I think that I thought, well, there's all kind of people in the world, you know, young people, old people, tall people, short people, black people, white people. And I guess I thought that I was like young people, old people, that I was like a short, young, white one. And that this was going to be the case forever.
That was your condition.
Right. And I don't know, what did I think about other people that, oh boy, they're not very smart shoppers. Look at the body that they got. I got this 20-year-old body. They got that 40-year-old body. So that I think I was astonished to discover that it wasn't going to stay that way. And, you know, I can't say that I've welcomed it. I can't say that from a physical point of view, no one likes getting older. I actually noticed, since I've been on this book tour for about 80 weeks, that I actually, a lot of people notice they start to look like their mothers, for instance. I just skipped that phase. I look just like my grandmother now. I went from, I just skipped that. I went from looking just like myself to looking like Lily Splaver in one fell swoop. And then I had dinner with my cousin in Chicago, and I said, I look like grandma now, don't I? And she said, yes, you do. That's where I am now from a physical point of view.
So what do you do with that feeling? I mean, do you feel like, well, I'm going to look like my grandmother with attitude, with defiance, I don't care? Or do you think, well, I'm going to be really depressed about this, or I will cosmetically change myself through makeup or plastic surgery? You know what I'm saying? Like, what do you do with that feeling?
Well, here's what I do about it. I look in the mirror and I think, you look better now than you're ever going to look again. And you're going to... If you have a picture taken of yourself today, in 5 years, you're going to look back and say, you look so young. You look fabulous. However, except for the look part of it, I like being older otherwise. I mean, there are advantages to it. First of all, everyone who's in charge of everything is someone you know. This is very helpful. This I like. And so I find that quite an upside. It doesn't balance it out. You know, I would rather, of course, be 20. But you don't get that choice, so you might as well take advantage of some of the upside of things. And there's certainly less urgency in life, which I also welcome. Now, a lot of people don't like being this age because it's certainly less exciting, but I'm happy to have it be less exciting.
So are you going to obsess about how you look, or are you going to not care about it?
Well, it isn't that I don't care about it. I'm pretty vain. It's just that, what can you do about it? I mean, you mean, am I going to have a facelift and stuff like that? I don't think so, because I think it's better to look like an earthling, don't you? I have no moral opposition to facelifts, but they only work for a couple years, and then you get this kind of Neptunian quality to your face. So I don't think that they don't have all the kinks out yet, as far as I'm concerned. I just don't think there's not that much at our disposal to do that much about it. So I kind of accept it. Also, I'm a heavy smoker. You know, there's a chance. How much further is this going to go? You know, I mean, that a lot of people worry about being really old. You know, I mean, actually an old person, like a 90-year-old person. And I don't worry about this too much.
I figure you've probably lost a lot of friends to AIDS. I'm just wondering, correct me if I'm wrong, but I just assume that you've had a lot of friends who have died. And if that's so, I was wondering how that's changed you, if at all, and changed what you want or what you expect out of life.
Well, I certainly have known a very large number of people who died of AIDS. I mean, really a large number, but hundreds of people. Only one very, very close friend has died of AIDS, but quite a few, you know, second-tier friends. Like, one of my best friends died. It's changed my life more than anything else has ever changed my life. It's changed my life tremendously. Not only for the reasons, personal reasons, which of course it makes you reassess things, etc., but also because it changed the culture so much, and particularly the cultural environment that I lived in, changed it completely. It disappeared. It completely disappeared. You know, an entire sensibility disappeared, an entire world, you know, but a world that I lived in disappeared.
Which specific world was that?
I mean, this certain kind of sensibility is gone. That was a kind of, it's hard to describe. People like, say, Charles Ludlam died. Mm-hmm. My friend Peter Hujar died. Antonio Lopez. I mean, these are all people that I was close to, that I knew really well, that I knew not only personally, but, you know, that kind of created the environment that I lived in. And it was a pre-political environment, you know, a sexual environment that was sex without politics, you know, homosexuality without gay politics. That doesn't exist anymore. It's disappeared. It was You know, now, of course, people say it was a ghetto sensibility, which it was to a certain extent. It was a marginal sensibility for sure. And it was a harbinger sensibility. In other words, you know, you can, may think, I don't mean you specifically, one might think Charles Ludlam would have no relationship to the larger culture at all. But in fact, of course he did. It just took 20 years. All people like that, all the people like that really affected the culture in a very slow way. In the interim, that was a separate environment that I lived in. And that's just completely gone.
So do you feel that there's less of a place for yourself now?
No place at all. No public place at all. It doesn't exist. I don't have that type of life at all anymore. Zero. It doesn't exist.
Will AIDS figure into the novel that you're writing?
Yeah, of course it does. But in no way is it an AIDS novel.
Right.
I mean, not by the furthest stretch. But of course it does. I mean, but it doesn't define it the way that I think people might expect it to. Mm-hmm. I have a certain objection to making a great metaphor out of AIDS. I think it's dangerous to do that. And I also think that in the end, it's not accurate. It is, no matter who makes that metaphor, largely the metaphor, the AIDS metaphor has been made by AIDS activists in their rush to not allow someone else to do that to it. I think it's quite important to remember that it's a virus. That's all. It's a virus.
Well, Fran, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Fran Lebowitz. Her new collection of essays is called The Fran Lebowitz Reader. Her children's book is called Mr. Chass and Lisa Sue Meet the Pandas. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.